You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Friday, 7 November, Chinese data an hour ago saw October exports contract for the first time in 8 months. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Pujatana from Perpetua Investment Managers, the FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee. I want to understand how it works. How do you get onto it? All of that. Let's go deep into the weeds here. Steve Binney from SAPI. Not great results, but decent prospects ahead. And I think they're probably peak debt for now. And thoughts from me on the two Michael Burry shorts. And the market is spooked. Should we worry about that? This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, Woolies blinks, hikes on-demand delivery fee by 29%, and Bloomberg Tesla shareholders approve $1 trillion pay package for Musk. Lots of T's and C's, however. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down 1.1%, NASDAQ down almost 2%. The East is all red, Sydney almost 0.5% down, Tokyo over 2% weaker, Hong Kong is 1% down, and Tencent almost 2% lower. Commodities mostly red, gold futures the exception, few dollars higher at $3,999, Brent $63.61, platinum $1,543, palladium 1,398. The rand is 1740. Bitcoin is 102,100. And top 40 opening call, red open, 850 points, little over 0.8% lower.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Pujatana, Perpetua Investment Managers. Pujo, appreciate the early morning time. I think the previous time we touched briefly on the FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee, which is a part of the Federal Reserve. The important part, perhaps, because they set the interest rates, the equivalent of our repo in South Africa. And I suppose in many senses, they're kind of like our MPC. Let's start with some simples. How many board members are there on this committee? And how do they get constituted?
Hi, Simon. Okay, so actually the FOMC has 19 total participants.
Wow.
7 members are the Board of Governors in Washington when all the seats are filled. And we know that at this point in time, all the seats are filled.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's 12 presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks, such as New York, Chicago, Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is that not all 19 get a vote at every meeting. Only 12 people vote on the policy decisions at any given meeting. So the 12 are the 7 governors who are the permanent voters, and then the New York Fed president, who's also a permanent voter. The reason for that is that New York's quite an important seat.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually put them as permanent because they wanted to prevent monetary policy being dominated by Washington alone. And it also ensured that market expertise was always represented.
Mm.
So what happens is that you've got those, so the 7 governors, the New York president is also permanent, and then 4 of the remaining 11 regional Fed presidents rotate annually. And this rotation schedule is published at least 2 years in advance, I think. I think you can get it off.
Yeah.
You can get the rotation schedule. So basically, in summary, you have all 19 that take part in the discussions and they give their views on the economy and the policy, but only 12 actually cast the votes. 7 are the governors, which who are the permanent voters. 1 is the New York Fed president. And then obviously the voting group gives, like, your vote rotates to give different regions of the U.S. representation over time.
Gotcha. Okay, and the Board of Governors, those 12 which are part of the sort of Federal Reserve, they, as I understand, they nominated by the president and are Senate confirmed.
Actually, so how that works is that, and actually it's interesting because their 5-year terms expire in February 2026. So the process is that the regional bank's directors evaluate and vote on the reappointment. The recommendation goes actually to the Board of Governors. And then the Board of Governors must reapprove the must approve the reappointment for the president to continue. So it's actually not the president that approves it. It's the Board of Governors. So the Board of Governors have two. I mean, so they're permanent seats,
mm-hmm.
but they also approve the 12 presidents of the regional Federal Reserve Banks.
Okay, is that how it comes to? Okay, and then it's also, there's the weirdness. For example, Jerome Powell, so he gets a, I think it's a 14-year term. His position as chair of the Federal Reserve is going to end in May next year, but he's a board member until 2028.
Yeah, so he still hasn't indicated whether he's going to continue as part of the board.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he steps down. I think generally once their term ends, they tend to step down. And I mean, I don't know if you saw, they've already published the five candidates that are in the running to replace Powell. I mean, if you look at the five finalists, they're all Trump's. I mean, they're all like supporting Trump's policies. They all favor interest rate cuts. So Waller is actually, I think, touted to be one of the more popular candidates to replace mm-hmm. Powell. But yeah, he's got a shortlist of five, and actually they plan to do a final proposal before Thanksgiving this year. So we should know around the 27th of the 27th of November. We should know. They should have a final list. They're doing a second round of interviews, and then they should have a final list by the 27th of November.
And there is the challenge you mentioned there. I mean, the five are all sort of Trumpites in the sense that they're following his policy. He wants lower rates. The challenge they have is their dual mandate, which is price stability and full employment. And I mean, at most times, that's a relatively easy. At this point in history, however, they are diverging and going different ways, which, respect to the members, does make a challenge.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually quite funny, but Cook, I was just reading, you know, and you know, we know that Trump is mm-hmm. dying and he wants Cook out of the board. But actually, Cook was actually pro-labor at this point. She was more worried about employment than she mm-hmm. was about inflation. So, I mean, it is true. That's why they're saying the December cut is not a foregone conclusion. The market's pricing about 65% chance of an interest rate cut now. But, I mean, it's data point upon data point. So they're going to watch the labor. They're going to watch inflation. Even Powell said he's more worried about labor than he is about inflation.
Yeah. There was his Jackson Hole pivot. The challenge, of course, is are they getting the data they need because the government is shut down? I mean, I'm thinking particularly, and I mean, they can get ADP, I suppose they can get some other private survey data, but they're not getting good old fashioned, you know, the bog standard, for example, labor data that we get every month.
No, and that's why it's going to be very difficult when the December meeting comes up, and it's not a foregone conclusion. And that's what he said in his meeting, in his speech as well. So, I mean, so it's actually quite funny, but Powell and Cook are actually more worried about the labor data than they are about inflation. So Trump is, so you know, you're almost like, they're not as hawkish.
Yeah.
They're waiting for the data. If the labor data is bad, they're actually going to cut rates. So, I mean, Trump gets his way regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. He gets it because, I mean, there is, I mean, okay, inflation's at 3%. We can debate that. But as you say, Lisa Cook, Jerome Powell, they both are worried, as are many others, because, well, they got the cut earlier. We'll see what happens in December. Bridget Tanner, Perpetua Investment Managers, appreciate the early morning, appreciate the insights. Give your money the return it wants without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Steve Binney, CEO of Sappi. We had results for year end and quarter end. September revenue down 1%, HEPS minus 15 US cents, no dividend declared. Steve, you mentioned in the results, and you've chatted around us over the year, your first quarter started strong, which would have been October to December last year, but weakened markedly from the beginning of this year, and it has continued for the 9 months of 2025.
Indeed, that's right. I think, you know, the back end of 2024, which is our first quarter, mm-hmm. was the macroeconomic environment was better at that time. Obviously, as we went into the calendar year 2025, we started to see significant global trade tensions. We saw a slowdown in a number of our key markets. And then subsequent to that, because of all that volatility and uncertainty, the selling prices for a number of our products dropped. So it's been a tough 9 months since then. And I think things are stabilizing a little bit at the moment, but definitely a tough year that we've just had.
A tough year. You mentioned some of the challenges. Obviously, tariffs came in, sort of started coming in, well, as early as January, Liberation Day in April. We understand that. Has it also been a demand story as well, though?
Look, it's fair to say that there have been challenges in the macroeconomic environment. Europe, as you know, is a big business for us, a big market for us. And the European economy has been subdued for a number of years. It's never truly recovered from COVID. And in fact, in our industry, sales volumes are not even back at pre-COVID levels. But there's no doubt that all the noise around the tariffs and the uncertainty that it created. Yeah, for example, Sappi is a big exporter of our dissolving pulp to China. Yeah. And that product's used to make clothes. And obviously, with the uncertainty between China and the US, we started to see a drop off on trade flows. And that had an indirect impact on Sappi, and it affected selling prices.
Yeah, you mentioned that as well, the price differential, and prompted Chinese swing mills to increase. Has that sort of laid itself out? You mentioned in the results a fairly volatile pricing in China there. Has that eased itself, or are you still seeing that?
Yeah, I think it's eased a little bit. DWP prices specifically dropped all the way up till about May, June. Mm-hmm. And then in the last quarter, we started to see a little bit of stability. And in fact, the prices went up a little bit. Obviously, we've had this recent announcement that there's been some kind of settlement between China and the US. I think that's going to create a little bit more stability as well. And interestingly, despite the low selling prices, the actual underlying demand for the product is actually pretty good at the moment. Okay. It's just selling prices have just come off so significantly over the course of the year.
Let's touch on your balance sheet. Net debt 35% higher. And a lot of this is a cash utilization and operations. The capital expenditure with your Somerset Mill project, which we'll get to in a bit. There's an issue with some euro-denominated debt. My sense, however, is that this is probably sort of peak debt and it will start now working its way down.
Yeah, that's right. And we had the big project that you referred to, and that's now completed. That cost us $500 million. And obviously, we knew there would be an impact from that on our balance sheet. At the same time, you know, we were unlucky because, you know, you don't expect the rand to strengthen, you know, so much against the dollar and the euro. And a lot of our debt is euro-denominated. So, you know, once again, we got that double whammy. And normally, what is strange, normally in these down cycles in our industry, they coincide with global uncertainty. And in those times, normally, emerging market currencies like the rand depreciate. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we get the perfect storm here where the rand is strengthening and selling prices for our product have been weaker. But, you know, coming back to the debt, yes, it has peaked now. The big capex is behind us. We are committed to reducing capex. Mm-hmm. It's going to be almost entirely focused on maintenance. And the levels we're looking at for the next couple of years are going to be less than $300 million a ton, which will enable us to generate cash and pay down that debt number.
And the Somerset Mill, which is now done in North America, that expansion project now concluded, does this give you a bit of a competitive advantage in the sense that it is in America and therefore not subject to tariffs when selling in America?
Very much so. You know, to be a domestic producer in the US, and I know I was complaining about tariffs, but in this instance, it will help us.
Yeah.
A lot of the volume, the competitors in that market have been European exporters, and they obviously have tariffs now. The fact that we're a domestic producer, these are in our favor. The American economy is remarkably resilient, despite all the challenges, and we're well positioned. We now have the best machines in the industry and low cost, highly competitive, and we'll benefit from the tariffs in this instance.
Yeah, tariffs are weird. They work both ways, and sometimes they are a benefit.
And I know. So I can't complain all the time.
No, 100%. Take what you can. South Africa, you mentioned your demand for containerboard strengthened in the second half of the year, particularly supported by robust citrus season, which is good news for our citrus farmers, but of course, good news for Sappi and your local production.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the farmers put out estimates at the beginning of the year, and the season ended up being much better than everybody had anticipated. And then, you know, as you look forward over the next 5 years, they're very bullish about the prospects. We're getting forecasts from them 6-8% a year. So we're very bullish about the containerboard business. And I think the citrus fruit exports for the South African economy is really wonderful. And, you know, obviously Sappi being the big supplier of the packaging for that is well positioned.
Yeah, in fact, there was an article at Cape Town Harbour is putting in a new storage facility for citrus export for that increased demand. Looking ahead, my sense is the business, Sappi, the part that you control is well positioned. The debt's going to come down. You've got the upgrades in North America. The bits that you can't control are beyond your control, and they might become more challenging. But broadly, the company is where you want it at this stage in the process.
Yes, I would agree. I think the things that we can control, I think we're doing a good job. The macroeconomic conditions this year have not helped us.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think we're taking all the right actions. I think we've got a great South African business. We've got a great US business. Our biggest challenges lie in Europe. And, you know, it's partially linked to the fact that, you know, the macro economy in Europe is in a tough place. And also Europe is a tough place to do business. It's higher cost. And there is excess capacity there. So our biggest challenge at the moment is solving that. We are closing capacity, trying to take out costs, but that's getting the most of our attention at the moment because we feel in the other regions we're in a good place, and now we have to resolve the European challenge.
Steve Binney, CEO of Sappi, appreciate the time.
The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Thoughts from me on all the worries flying around in terms of markets, and is the market going to crash? And there's a lot out there that is spooking people right now. The US had October most layoffs in over 20 years during the month. We just spoke with Pooja there around the worries about the labor market. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley CEOs are saying a possible 10 to 20% market correction. We chatted with Kira around that yesterday. The Michael Burry report, he is short Nvidia and Palantir. Look, Palantir is on a price to sales of 80. That stock is massively elevated. Nvidia forward PE only about 30, which is, well, they got to do the numbers because an important word there was forward. The Buffett indicator, stock market is more than twice the size of the US GDP. And that usually has freaked Buffett. You also hear people saying, you know, the Buffett's got, what, 300 odd billion cash on the balance sheet. But relative to the size of the company, it is the most amount of money, but it's not completely out of kilter. That's where a lot of the stuff is getting mixed in the picture. Yeah, Michael Burry is short. You know what? He runs a hedge fund. Sometimes he is short stocks. Valuations are in places stretched. There are, you know, a lot of the spend we're seeing in the hyperscalers is from free cash flow. Although, as Nick Kunzer pointed out on Monday, Meta Platforms is going to be picking up $20 billion of debt next year, so that's no longer the free cash flow. The point is, markets do decline. So a 5% pullback, you expect a 1, 2, maybe even 3 of those during a course of a year during a bull market. A 10% correction, that happens every year or two. A 20% correction, about every 3 to 5 years. So 10% down is very common. We saw one back in April. Bull markets also climb a wall of worry. It's weird. No one sort of feels comfortable. We should be, right? Bull market, markets at all-time highs means our worth is at all-time highs. But there's always reasons to be worried. Some more fun stats. Bull markets typically last a little over 5 years, 250% return. Bear markets last about a year for a -31 return. Here's the thing. If you want to be worried about stuff, you'll always find stuff to worry about. That's not the problem. There's always enough to be scared of. But are we really smart enough, or maybe lucky enough, to get out right on time and then to get back right in time again? We want to make those two big calls. And I think far too easy to exit and the market carries on running and then you're left standing on the side with a pile of cash and a market that's 5, 10, 20% higher. I don't think we have that skill or that luck. So my sense, and then that's excluding, of course, we've got to take into costs of exiting, re-entering, and any tax implications. For me, it's simple. I'm a long-term investor. I don't stress the bull market. It makes me richer. I know that there will be bear markets. I know there will be corrections. I know there will be crashes. I don't know when they will happen. When they do, yeah, they are scary. But we have recovered from every single one. And I've got time on my side. So no stress from me. And really, don't stress it. Just carry on doing what you do. And that's our question today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Are you worrying about the sell-off, or are you that long-term investor who says, absolutely not a worry, it's just something that happens? That's it for today. I was chatting with Ken Nyana from Prime XBT. We're talking about the blue label listing of CelC. No dates, no prices. We asked you if you thought it was an attractive investment. Almost two-thirds said no, just another telco. Quarter said we need to see valuations. Rest said yes, a great business. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again Monday, South Africa's debt trajectory.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.